TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The Global Financial Casino. If you are a longtime listener to TUC Radio, you have heard this program before. It is one of the few compelling explanations on how the global financial casino works and one of our most popular tapes. Bernard Liotard makes the case that today the global financial markets are more powerful than national governments. Investors and banks determine much of our future by influencing the global economies. Bernard Liotard has the professional experience that makes his argument compelling. He was, until 1994, a successful currency trader in the Cayman Islands. Before that, he was one of the chief planners at the Central Bank of Belgium. We are repeating this program in conjunction with, next week, an antidote to global financial speculation. National governments, NGOs, and community-based organizations call for control of the global casino by a new tax, the Tobin tax. Here today, an eloquent and intriguing explanation of the problem. Next week, a possible solution. Here's Bernard Liotard.
First of all, what is going on in the financial system? The BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, which is a central bank of central banks, has done a few surveys on global foreign exchange trading. And here are the numbers that they've come up with. Here are billions of dollars per day, all right? Understand the volume per day, working day, 5 days a week. And here are the years. In 1980, there was $150 billion traded per day. This rose to $660 billion by 88, reached $880 in 92, $1.4 trillion in 1995, which is the number that came out in May last year. My estimate that this year, say last Friday, we have close to $2 trillion per day being traded. This means in clear that, say, the economy of the United States, the entire GNP per year is being churned over in the financial system every 3 days. Okay? That means every service, every, you know, piece of bread, every haircut, everything, you know, is being churned over in 3 days in for the whole year. Okay? Now, of course, part of this is the real economy. Real economy, what I'm talking real here, is the real trades. In other words, people that import oil, export cars, make investments in portfolios in Japan, or buy a corporation in Europe, or build a plant in Japan, in Hong Kong. All this stuff would be part of what the foreign exchange for real transactions, including tourism as well, like for Mexico or say, Spain. So all that is here, the blue line. In other words, in 1980, about 80% of foreign exchange transactions had to do with the real economy. In 1980, 80%. 20% was speculative. I would say in the 1970s, there was probably about 10% of speculative and 90% real economy. In other words, there always have been a little bit of frosting on the cake on speculation going on even in the days when there were no floating exchanges. Today, this is down to 2.5% real economy and 97.5% speculative. Now, basically, what was the frosting on the cake has become the cake. And the real economy, real being everything that we can think of that actually produces goods or commodities or whatever, has become just a small little sliver on what's going on. Now, the causes for this have been cumulative to three processes. First one was already mentioned, again, Nixon's non-system. Nobody in his right mind would have designed the system that we went into when we unleashed the dollar from any kind of exterior reference. This created a systemic reason why this game can go on. The 1980s, both Reagan and Thatcher, and introduced the deregulation strategies, which enabled a lot more freeway of movement of capital on international levels for corporations that normally wouldn't have done it. And the Baker Plan, in fact, had a main objective to open the countries. There were 16 countries in the third world that were part of the Baker Plan where that same strategy was applied. So we have created a whole movement towards deregulation on an international global level. That was the second level. And the third one is, in fact, I would say, the structural, deep-lying phenomenon below the whole thing, which is a technological shift. This is the electronification of money, the computerization of the market systems. Even if you wanted to roll back this thing, this would still remain. In other words, we will not go back. If you go back to another monetary system, we now have fully integrated, the first fully integrated market system, completely electronic, is operational and will remain so. Okay? So these three things together have explained the phenomenon we're talking about. Now, what is the business viewpoint? Well, the first thing that we should get rid of is one of the number of illusions that our textbooks in economics talk about. Textbooks in economics, Economic 101, say that corporations and individuals compete for markets and resources. This is not true. This is a joke. Okay? Corporations and individuals compete for money using markets and resources. So when you understand that viewpoint, things rather shift rather easily. Okay? Well, now we have to look from the business viewpoint in two different realms. The financial businesses, banks, fund investments, brokers, insurance companies, and what I would call the real economy. So here we're talking about the financial businesses first. This process that we just talked about of the opening of the system with the opportunities of having floating exchanges at the same time has created a new asset class. In technical terms, there are asset classes like real estate, bonds, stocks, and commodities, and now currencies. So the medium of exchange has become simply an asset class to be played into the portfolios. Now, this particular asset class has some fantastic advantages from an investment viewpoint. The first one is extraordinarily low transaction costs. Placing a few billion dollars in foreign exchange costs literally very little, a fraction of a percent. The reason is that we're talking of the spread between the buy and the sell in the markets, which is for major currencies only a fraction of a percent. Compared to stocks transactions, this is dirt cheap. Second, we mentioned already the 24-hour market environment. We have a fully integrated market system where we can actually play around the clock. The third one, this is the deepest market around by a long shot. If you have a few billion dollars to place, okay, bringing it in the stock market is going to move the stocks that you're getting into, even except for some of the deepest bond markets that would still be true, except for the U.S. and some of the European ones, $1 billion will move you to the bond market. In foreign exchange, it won't make a blip. So if you have a substantial amount of money to move around, this is the place to do it. You can get in and out without affecting the market. Finally, volatility creates profitability. So we now have a linkage between profits and volatility. The worst thing that can happen in currency markets is that you buy $1 billion worth of Deutsche Mark and the Deutsche Mark sits there. You know, you're basically losing your time, all right, and therefore your money. So movement is essential to the investment quality of this new asset class. Currency trading for larger banks, say the New York-based banks or the London-based banks, typically are at least 20% of the earnings, and in a good year, it's 50%. So lending money is not the cheapest way of making money. Okay? This is the place to do it. This is their biggest profit center. Now, real businesses, businesses that do mining, make cars, electronics, whatever. First point that has to be made is that the foreign exchange risk is now the biggest single risk in business, in international business, by far. I.e., the business risk if you went to create a chemical plant in India, the business risk is minimal compared to the foreign exchange risk. Many investments are not being made simply because the foreign exchange risk is not manageable. Okay? The way that corporations have dealt with this new risk, there are two strategies that have been followed, and you're very familiar with them. You've seen the results of them. The first of all is decentralization of production and marketing, because that's not where the risk is, and also that is where adaptation to local circumstances is best handled. Hence, the investment, the expansion of what you've been talking about into other countries of production facilities. But increased centralization at the same time, and that's something that people have not been aware of, we're talking about looking at this thing, you see all the corporations spreading it out. However, they've been centralizing the financial and the treasury functions, much more so than they ever did before. Say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when you had a big plant somewhere in Germany for an American company, they would handle their finances there. Not anymore. This is done centrally. Second thing is that a typical career path for a CEO now is different from what it used to be. Since the 80s and 90s, it's definitely finance people. Finance people are the ones who deal with the shots. So that shift in career path has also changed the mood and is a reaction to the new risk that we're talking about. Now I have two questions. The first one is, what do you think is the largest U.S. financial institution today? Okay. General Electric. General Electric is currently the largest financial institution in the country. And number two, it is the largest profit center at General Electric. Is not defense, not the bulbs, not the power stations. It is their treasury department and their financial department. That's the largest single profit center of General Electric. In the last 25 years, banks as a source of financing have dropped in America from 75% of total supply of credit to 26.5%. In other words, banks are not the big players anymore in terms of supplying credit. The whole thing has shifted already. Second question is, who do you think is taking the largest foreign exchange risk? Not corporations. What kind of individual or kind of corporation is taking the largest foreign exchange risk today? It's the people who are in one single currency. Who have their real estate, I mean, they own their house that sits in dollars or Deutsche Mark or wherever they are living. They have their savings account in that same currency, and they have their income in that same currency. They are the biggest risk takers in currencies today because they are sitting on, it looks like nothing moves. But the whole thing is, when you're in floating exchanges, not being diversified is crazy. It's like having a stock portfolio with one stock. And because you know that stock. Well, good luck. Okay? Now, what are the implications for this? What we just happened on? The first one is that governments, the nation states, are basically in the process of losing power, and I don't see how they will recover it, by the way. The process is a lot deeper than just the financial system. The technological dimension is one of the key dimensions. The information revolution makes this nation state irrelevant. Okay? It's the one entity that cannot manage, has no benefit to gain in power and only to lose against the other players who are playing on a multilateral level. So markets are currently policing governments, as was pointed out by previous people. Through crisis. That's what's interesting. In other words, it's crisis situation that gives the signal of policing. There's no negotiations, There's no talking. There's nobody sitting around the table to say, this is what we're going to do this. Or how about negotiating this part? It's not the way it happens. You suddenly end up with a crisis in a particular currency in a country. And now that also creates the volatility phenomenon we talked about. The pound in 1991, the Scandinavian or the Italians in 92, 93, Mexico in 94 are four examples. Now, one of the interesting will be when there will be a currency like the United States, dollar will be attacked through the system, which has no reason not to. All the reserves of all the central banks together, okay, is about $600 billion. So in a normal trading day, in half a day, all the reserves are gone. So, okay, we're not in the same game anymore. As long as there's not a big fire, that's fine. But we're having a fire department which has nice hand pumps with a World Trade Center being built. As long as there's no fire in the World Trade Center, everybody will be fine. Okay? The second major consequence is instability. I'm going to give you two quotes, one from Paul Volcker and one from George Soros. They're at opposite ends of the spectrum, one being a central banker or an ex-central banker, and George Soros being the speculator, the largest speculator today. They basically say the same thing. They basically say in a polite form the same thing. Paul Volcker quotes, "Biggest concern today is a growing constituency for instability." In other words, there are lots of more people now that have an interest in instability while before they had interest in stability. So the only people that are still interested in stability are the governments. All the rest is not there on the same side anymore. The second thing is the quote by Soros, and Soros has absolutely no interest in saying what he's saying here because he's making money. His living is coming from what he, from continuing the game. Instability is cumulative, so that eventually the eventual breakdown of freely floating exchanges is ensured. So that eventual breakdown of freely floating exchanges is ensured. If you have an unstable system, it's just a question of when it will flow off the handle. All right? My personal opinion, which is the reason I stopped trading 2 years ago, by the way, is that it's only a question of when this thing will blow apart. Not a question whether. There is no way that this will hold, right? The next one here, somewhere, will be the dollar crisis. When the dollar crisis is gone, we have no system. This, there is no historical precedent in the last 200 years of a collapse of this nature. The scale we're dealing with, this is a global phenomenon. All currencies in the world are based on the dollar. So if you have a crisis on the dollar, you take the linchpin and boom. The third consequence is the one you're very familiar with. As all the national currencies, well, all, a lot of, you know, $1.4 trillion per day is being churned around in the cyber economy, the financial cyber economy, at the bottom of the totem pole, there's just no medium of exchange available. National currencies are not available at the grassroots level for the poorer part of the population. And as structural unemployment increases, my personal opinion is that we can grow very well, thank you, without employment, okay? And the technologies will shift us that further that way. The age of labor as a key component in production is gone, all right? We're beyond the curve. So it's going to drop. Now, as a consequence, if you don't have a job, you don't have money. What money? The national currency. So what has happened in the countries, in the developed countries, is a brand new phenomenon, brand new since the Depression, because it happened in the Depression as well. In the United States, there were over 5,000 local currencies in the 1930s. Okay, is an explosion again of local currencies, currencies that are not the national currency. The best known system of the local exchange trading systems, the LET systems, which just started in Canada initially. The time dollars are now very popular in America, and I think with the deregulation of the Social Security, it will spread like fire. I'm expecting time dollar systems to be very active in the United States. It's basically where people trade hours. An hour of service for an hour service. It started in retirement homes. Ithaca Hours is another one that's well known. Now, they currently have an inventory of over 1,000 communities in the world that already have local currencies operational right now. Now, the ones that I have an inventory for is New Zealand, Australia. New Zealand, by the way, is the only country where the central bank and the government is supporting the creation of local currencies because it solves its unemployment problem. I'm forecasting that this will spread. The New Zealand experiment is a precedent to look at. Australia is starting doing the same thing. Canada, United Kingdom, Scandinavia, Germany, Switzerland, and France. The last country here is interesting. 2.5 years ago, there were zero local currencies in France. Today, there are over 300. The U.S., there are much fewer. I mean, there are about like a dozen or 15 that I know about. By the way, it relates directly to unemployment. The next upswing in unemployment in America, you're going to see local currencies developing here. What can be done about it from your perspective? Well, I guess there are two ways that one can see this. The first one is trying to convince to change the existing system. Personally, I've given up on that. I also believe, and I wish good luck anybody who wants to do it. For every single generation in the last 200 years, there have been books written about how terrible the banking and the monetary system is exploiting the people. This has been happening systematically. I can give you references for 200 years. Not a single thing has changed about it. Okay, and I think that will not change that way. It will change when it collapses. And perhaps the good or the bad news, depending on which side you want to put yourself, is that it will collapse fairly soon. So I wouldn't spend a lot of energy in trying to attack it. Spend energy in doing something else. Now, first of all, the premises for the strategy I'm talking about are the following. The first point is that we should understand that money is not a thing. Anybody can create money. You hear this? Anybody can create money. Let me tell you what it means. Money is simply an agreement within a particular community to use something, just anything, really. There's a whole alphabet of things that have been used for money in the past as a medium of exchange. So the key part is an agreement. Some of those agreements can be, we could do agreement between the two of us and have a currency for 2 days. There were cigarettes used in World War II as a medium of exchange on the front. You could use, you know, it can be temporary, it can be permanent. It's an agreement within a community. The community can be worldwide, as long as there's a treaty that imposes the United States dollar as a reserve currency. The United States dollar is supposed to be acceptable by all central banks around the world, and therefore by all banks. That's by agreement. It's not by God will, it's by agreement. So that's the first point. What you need for doing this is only two things. You need to have an agreement, so therefore pick your community and make the agreement with it. And second, an information management capability, because once you have the agreement, the rest is information handling. With the second wave of the information revolution, specifically the internet part and the micro information possibilities, for a couple of $100 you can have a computer now, the information handling capacity is now available at the grassroots level. Okay? Now, with these premises, I'm proposing a three-step strategy for non-government organizations. The first one is learn more, support existing well-designed complementary local currency systems, and encourage new ones. Now, I'm insisting on the word well-designed. There are good ways and bad ways of doing this. And complementary. Do not claim to make a currency that will displace the national currency. Okay? I'm just back from a city in Brazil where a third of the local income is not in, or of the normal citizen, is not in national currency. But the national currency is still there. It's a complementary system. You're always going to pay your gasoline and buy your computer, by the way, in dollars. All right? So expect to do that. So have a mix of the two. The unit of account that I would suggest, which is already spreading around in many of the local systems right now, although there are some exceptions in that, it's spotty, is to use the hour of work as a unit of account. The reason I'm suggesting that is that it's a universal measure, and it's therefore, you know, not a, not subject to speculation. Okay, it's an hour. They're made of 60 minutes anywhere in the world. Okay, almost all existing local currency systems, the 1,000 that I'm talking about, have been created by non-government organizations, by non-profits on the ground. So that is what happens. That is the way it arises. So use it. Finally, it enables non-government organizations to get more bang for the buck. If you have a budget of, say, $100,000 in your current strategy, you could do $200,000, $300,000 worth of work if you have a local currency that you manage yourself as a way of paying part of what you have people do. The second step, which is specifically the groups that are around the table here today, because the other part has already happened, is happening, whether we do something about this today. The second step is have the non-government organizations develop a supranational clearing system among these currencies. Okay? Now, nobody else will do this for you. Nobody else will do this. You're not going to have the banks do this. This is ideal role for non-government organizations. By the way, for historical purposes, I just remind you that the first clearing system internationally was set up by a non-government organization. It was called the Templars in the 12th century. When a pilgrim in England wanted to go to Italy or to Santiago de Compostela in Spain, he didn't take his gold with him. That would be totally suicidal because he would be killed five times on the way to get the gold. So he went to the temple in London, gave the money there, and they gave him a little piece of paper. And he could go to Santiago and get his money there because the Templars were represented there. It's exactly the situation that non-government organizations are in. You can clear the system. It's pure information exchange. The third step is, if and when the current dominant monetary system will get in trouble and collapses, by default, what you're dealing with may be the exchange system. So by designing it right, by modeling it correctly, we can, in fact, create the next system. That is my point.
That was Bernard Liotard, former currency trader and chief planner at the Bank of Belgium. Next week's program will present a possible solution. At the recent IFG teach-in on globalization at the United Nations, respected speakers such as Vandana Shiva, Martin Kaur, and David Corton all called for a tax to be levied on speculative currency transactions. This tax is called the Tobin tax. Tune in next week to hear how it works. You can get this talk with Bernard Liotard from TUC Radio for $12. Your tape order helps support our work. The tape includes next week's program on the Tobin tax. For a credit card order, call us anytime, toll-free, at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877 TUC tape, or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening.